Vacation starts with VA. Whether you're feeling beachy, mountainy, or every-y in between, you'll find all that you love all in one trip to Virginia. Start yours at virginia.org.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. Another week kind of comes to an end. Like every day seems to just be exactly the same as the day before at the moment. Thanks to anybody who came and listened to my talk this week on Wednesday on YouTube. Unfortunately, although the sound was better this time, I have to use the microphone on my computer. Unfortunately, I only had like mono sound, so it's only in one person's, only in one ear. So yeah, it's quite a steep learning curve, this OBS kind of software kind of thing. So I'll probably do another one on Wednesday. I might do one that's was a bit too like a bit too much swearing apparently in the other one. So I might try and do one a bit more family friendly. I might do one about going across Greenland maybe, which has got lots of funny stories. Although the only thing I'm worried about for being family friendly, I persuaded the two women on the trip to go on the pill so they wouldn't have periods, and didn't work out. So I don't know if that's family friendly. But, you know, I suppose you can fuck it, say what you want, can't you? So that'll be on Wednesday, 8 o'clock. I'm finding it less stressful because someone complained about the one I did about going to Denali, that it was crap and I should stick to writing books, which is always good to get like positive, you know, good feedback. So I had this idea I was going to put a lot more effort in to the next one I did, but then I just couldn't be asked to do that. So I just, you know, so I think it's, I got so much on at the moment that it's, you know, you just haven't got time to do things well. They just have to be the way they are, really. Speaking of busy, like I know I've been saying this about a year, but I really feel like I'm kind of getting to the end of the down book. Although today I was talking to Paul Tattersall, who lives up in Gairloch in Scotland, who's like a great climber, and he was my best man when I got married. He's a cool guy, does a lot of guiding on Sky and stuff like that, super fit guy. But I was telling him about the book, how the idea of the book is, you know, you're distilling all this information and you're trying to make it you're trying to simplify it so people can have one source of information. Like people can argue whether it's the right information, but it's just all in one place. So instead of saying like a simple things like tying your ropes together if you're abseiling, you know, it is an easy answer, but it doesn't seem that easy if you go looking on the internet. So he was like, oh, so you're basically writing a book that's simplifying everything, but it's like 400 pages long. I'm like, yeah, I guess I am. So I had the idea that what I should do is in the chapter, like the book's kind of broken down into like man-powered, person-powered descent, like just general ideas about how to get down off mountains and how to get out of the wilderness or whatever. So that's like a chapter, and then there's chapters about general safety, chapters about communication in relation to abseiling, but also it's got a broader thing. Like I've noticed on my travels that there isn't really that good a method of people identifying that they're at the top of the pitch and they want to get lowered off if you're sport climbing. And I've seen a hell of a lot of like near death experiences from people who have this really kind of casual, like, okay, you can lower me down, or okay, you know, I'm there, or you know, and you get people where people get taken off belay because they think they're seconding someone up, but actually they're lowering someone down. I know someone got killed where someone couldn't tell, you know, someone could see that someone was being taken off belay, and all there's like lots of stuff where we don't really have a really sort of formal thing. So in the book, instead of saying like, okay, lower me down. You know, that's it, basically, is I've gone for this very formalized, like, Bele ready, Bele ready, you know, Bele ready. You know, so you're like, you say, you know, it's communication and like it's signal and response and this kind of stuff. So yeah, so I'm sure people will really not think that's a great idea or like it's just bullshit. But I think the problem with a lot of that kind of climbing, I think climbing is very cool. People like to be really nonchalant. Like I've just been writing the bit about when you throw your ropes down, when you cast your ropes down off the top of an abseil. Now, if you're the one who's like, right, let's separate the two ropes. I want to like snake the two ropes out so they're all laid out, really hanked, and I'm going to do this special little coil, rescue coil, alpine bomb coil, and I'm going to like chuck them off one at a time. You know, it's like it's very thorough and it's very like abseil Nazi, and it's like the best way to do it. But who wants to, you know, it's a bit uncool. Like, just get all your ropes, just grab them and just chuck them over the edge and just let them all tangle up and get caught and everything. Like, that's a much more cool way of doing it. So I think climbers in general, you don't get this in like, probably you don't get this in like base jumping or cave diving, is they're like, I'm a bit too cool for that. A bit too cool to say, belay on. You know, it's like, oh God, it's a bit like, you know, climb when ready. You know, like it's a bit too, you know, a bit too instructor type person. Someone who's like, has loads of screw gates, that kind of thing. So I've been trying to sort of think of some different ways of doing it. So like bringing in some techniques and how people do things in like the rescue kind of area, rope access, canyoneering, some other kind of things, and trying to have like this kind of uniform, is it uniform? You know, sort of uniform theory of combined theory of descending off mountains. And so the book also includes like lowering, escaping. I wasn't going to have belay devices, but I've actually put it in there now, you know, how to lower someone on a plaquette and all that kind of stuff. So, but I had this idea that what I should do, I should just condense, just have one chapter, like literally one page in the book, where I just take all the information. Because really, it's really, really, really simple. Just take all that information, just condense it down to one page. Like, this is the knot to use. This is the knot to use on the end of your rope. This is the device to use. This is the prusik you should use. You know, this is how you should throw your ropes down. This is how you should pull your ropes, blah, blah, blah. And just, like, really, you know, really bring it down to, like, the absolute, you know, basics. So you could have it on a, you could just have it on a credit card. You know, have a little tiny thing in your wallet where, like, this is the default, you know, technique. And then by knowing all the other stuff, like there's like a huge section, like advanced abseiling, which includes like loads of crazy shit that no one's ever seen before, like some crazy stuff. And there's a whole bit about problem solving, which has got loads of crazy stuff about how to, you know, how to rappel on like, how to do a retrievable rappel on like four ropes and loads of weird stuff, like how to do a 60 meter abseil with one rope that's retrievable, that doesn't include like a fifi hook and things, and those things, maybe you'd never have to do it in the whole of your life. You know, maybe you'd never have to use any of those techniques, but knowing them, knowing them, I think I've mentioned on this podcast, when I was climbing in Kenya, I was with someone who broke his leg, and we had to like abseil off a route, and he had a broken leg, and you know, like you kind of learn all this stuff, but it's, you know, when you have to put it into practice, often it all kind of goes out of your head. Like a really good thing to remember is there's a big difference between panic and speed, which is, you know, kind of very, very common. Like I've had a few experiences when I've been with people who were like super experienced and super knowledgeable, but when things went wrong, they were like totally useless. They knew it all and they were qualified in it, but when it came down to it, they weren't able to apply that kind of information. Where sometimes when someone doesn't have any of that information, they'll just immediately, pull it together, like sort of work things out and come up with a solution. There's a really good book to read is a book called Stress Effect, which is all about how people, like, it begins with your man hitting the flock of birds and having to land the plane in the Hudson. And it, you know, it goes into a lots of very, it's a very detailed kind of book about, you know, how we problem solve and cognitive ability and everything else. But it's very interesting. But it seems to be that there's all these models of how people make decision making, how they come to a conclusion, and they're very sort of formalized. But it turned out that when they actually tested people who were in, you know, in really stressful situations, like, you know, business people, soldiers, whatever, that they were able to they made the decision almost immediately, and then they would have to try and work out how they were going to do it. You know, so something would happen, and then they would almost immediately know what they were going to do, and then they would have to somehow come round to working out how they're going to do it and persuade everybody else. So, you know, you'd have this really formalized way of coming to a decision, but really the person who was like the dominant force had already decided what was to be done immediately. So it's quite interesting. So the book I really feel like I'm getting to the end of it now. But it's always all the little tiny, you know, when your man painted the Sistine Chapel, I bet it was like, oh, you need to, you know, you need, even if you've got to paint the feathers on the angel's wings or something, there'd be one little thing that I've, you know, it'd be like a little detail that'll take ages. Like all the diagrams are all numbered, and then they're all numbered in the description. And some of the descriptions like very, very technical, very long. So all of them at the moment have no numbers on, so I have to go back through and put all those in. And but hopefully it'll be soon. I don't know if anyone can even get books at the moment. The book is basically the only way to make it commercially viable for me to do a book like this. I could never do it with a publisher, because it wouldn't work out financially. So I do it through print on demand through Amazon. So Amazon print the book. So I write the book, illustrate the book, design the book, and then it means that I get I'd have to like divide the profit up between lots of different people. It's not that like publishers rip you off. It's just that there just isn't enough money in publishing for anyone to really make any money out of it. They have to just sell shitloads of like cheap books to make a living. When really books, you know, books should cost, you know, should cost you like £100. You know, like a good book should, someone spent a lot of time writing, like a good, like a technical book should really cost you the same as a book you'd buy like at university, like a law book or something. Probably more than a law book, because a lot, you know, there's a huge amount of work that goes into it. But unfortunately for the book writing people, it's, you know, a book is almost the same price as it was, you know, like 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You know, you can buy a paperback for like £5 or whatever. Hopefully the same can be said about ropes and rock boots and things. Like the price has been very, you know, often doesn't represent the amount of like specialized knowledge or, you know, stuff that goes into that kind of thing. Where if you're making fleeces or, you know, if you're North Face, you know, you got a lot of, you know, it's good. But I get quite a lot of criticism about selling books through Amazon. Like people are like, Amazon's like the devil and all that kind of stuff. And I don't really agree with that, but I can understand why people think that. But Amazon sell 80% of all the books sold in the world. So for me, I always think you should just kind of exploit the fuck out of people, out of things, out of technology. You just cannot be that person who, you know, the guy who owns a typewriter repair shop, who is wondering what happened to all his business. You know, you just have to, you know, work with these things. You know, once upon a time, there was millions and millions and millions of women who were working as typists, like, you know, probably the number one, you know, kind of semi-professional job for women. And there's no women doing that anymore. You know, those women are doing other things. And so that's, you know, the whole tax thing is, you know, tax is an interesting subject. Having just lived in a country where no one pays any tax, it made me, you know, how dynamic and how there was very little poverty made me question the whole tax thing. But that's the tax thing is a very difficult thing to even. It's one of those big topics that we don't talk about, especially not in England. But it's a very interesting topic. So, speaking of controversial issues, I know I don't like to speak about the thing that is currently happening. But I had a few interesting experiences this week. Where I live here in Galway at the moment, we live next to a river, and it's actually on like university campus for some reason. Like Vanessa's mum and dad, like on, well, Vanessa's mum is like quite interesting. That when she was a child, she was given away to another family, to a couple, didn't have any children with, and someone else gave another child to this couple. So this was before adoption or anything else. It's a very Irish kind of story. And so she grew up in this house all her life, and now she's like 75. So, you know, for 75 years, well, 70 years, she was given away when she was like quite little. You know, she's been living in this house, and as she's been living here, like the University of Galway has kind of got bigger and bigger and bigger, and kind of gone all the way around it. The whole of her house is like basically in the university campus. It's kind of really, really weird. What's that film? There's that science fiction film from like the black and white one. Anyway, it's kind of weird. But where we are, like you can like walk along the river. It's quite a nice little walk. It's like 5K. So I've been running it, but then I was getting a bit of shin splints because I've got really crap trainers that are probably more for like doing weights than going for running. But you can go for this like 5K like walk along the river and back. And part of it's owned by the university. So the university decided that they would put these metal barriers up to stop people walking along one little tiny section of it. Like there's no way you could barrier off the whole area, but they just put this one area, this barrier, and they actually put five barriers, one in front of the other, and all tie them all together with rope. So what people did, people can only go out for 2 kilometers outside their house. Like, this is the most perfect place to walk. It's outside. It's by the river. It's just perfect. So everyone has been going out and climbing over this wall. You know, it's like the wall's not very high. It's just next to the barrier. So it's like ridiculous. It's like, you know, you get to the barrier, you walk 5 feet to the side, climb over a wall and go around it. And people have been doing this for like 7 or 8 weeks. Now the wall is getting totally trashed, but also like, You're funneling everyone into this one little bit of wall where everyone's climbing over it. You know, like if, you know, I'm very, I don't actually think this thing is actually transmitted that much by people touching things. I think it's mainly by people being ill and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, but this, you know, we're not allowed to think that because then we might question whether the whole mask thing maybe masks are a good idea. Anyway, but That's another topic. So everyone has been funneled into this area, and it's. I think I said on this podcast like a long, long time ago that this coronavirus thing would come down to sort of institutional cowardice, and in a way, it's kind of a good example of there's someone in the security office who can see all these people doing this, and he's like, got nothing. Look, I'm just doing my job. I'm just doing my job. You know, this is my job. You know, we've got. You know, I've done my job. You know, it doesn't matter that we're making things worse. I've done my job. So the other day, a woman fell off the wall climbing over it, and she was like, she'd hurt herself. And Vanessa kind of came across her, and everyone was just kind of climbing over her. And so she came back to here, and she's like, oh, we need to give us. You know, she was like, get some chocolate and a cup of tea with some sugar in it or something. So we have to call the ambulance. So we went back over there, and I was like, oh, this is fucking stupid. Like, everyone was climbing over this poor woman. So I was like, fucking hell, let's untie this fence. So we started untying all these barriers with these bits of rope on, and we pulled them all apart. And then people were kind of coming on either side of us. And I was like, freedom! And, you know, all this kind of like making a joke of it. And people were like really freaked out. And then we opened it and we're like, look, just go through there. Cause like there's a woman down there and she's like hurt herself and the ambulance is coming. And some people wouldn't walk through it. It was like, do you know when you see the experiments where it's like, oh, this is some kind of trap, you know, like there was something there. Now there isn't. Is this like am I going to get into trouble? And it was like really interesting experiment, you know, on human beings and, you know, how, I don't know. I find it really interesting. But then the other thing I saw the other day, which was we went down to the harbour here in Galway. It was like really, really beautiful. It was like a romantic night out. We had a pizza, and we went and had this sat on the grass and had this pizza near the harbour. And everyone was spread. You know, there was like people around, but people were spread out by quite a long margin. You know, people were maybe like 200 meters apart. You know, all over. You know, it's just scattered around this kind of harbour kind of area. It wasn't like super busy. And there was a couple sitting, and they were obviously like drinking some beer or something. And here, like a policeman in Ireland is called a guard. And we saw this guard like coming along, and you know, people were just sitting down. Some people had like a guitar, like there was like three people sat together. And you know, she was coming along, and every group, she'd stand there for like 5 minutes talking to them, and then they would have to get up and then they would leave, you know, like, oh, you're not allowed to, you know, enjoy yourself. You're not allowed to sit here. And so, you know, I don't want to repeat this. We're hearing this all the time, but they came along to this poor couple. And the next thing, the guard like picks up the person's beer and starts pouring it into the sea. And because you're not allowed to drink outside in Galway. And what I thought was funny, it was like the, you know, like everyone, we're always told like about the new normal. But what we don't know is the old normal is still in force. So it's it's kind of very, very interesting. So but back to the real McCoy. So here, so this evening, this today, I'm going to talk. I'm going to go through some questions. So I've had a lot of questions. So I had some questions this week, emails, and got some old ones here, and some questions from my YouTube channel. Now I'm intending to end up doing some proper stuff on YouTube, some like technical stuff, but I'm just getting around to it. So I am going to get around to it. So anyway, so a few questions for this this podcast. Some of these are a bit blind, so I'll just read them, see what it says. Have you ever had to solo rescue a partner from a crevasse? I guess it depends how you define rescue. Like I guess if you weren't there, they would have fallen all the way in and died. So that's probably, I don't think I've ever had to set up a haul system or anything like that. And I don't think many people ever really do set up a haul system. It's like probably one of these things that you practice, but in reality, it's probably, not very common to have to rescue somebody. And it's probably more about, avoiding falling into crevasses. It's probably more important, especially if there's two of you. Like I've fallen into crevasses like plenty of times, but I've never fallen like right into a crevasse. And generally, those kind of crevasses where they're, you know, like you see in the films, you can generally spot those. I guess I've done a lot of stuff where I had the places where there was really massive crevasses. I've generally always had skis on, like when I was in, places where you get a lot of crevasses. It's like Alaska and places. Some of the worst crevasses you can get are actually these really, really small ones where you can just like kind of fall in and break your leg or something. I often find they're more kind of worrying. I think a lot of it is like having good sort of skills between the two of you. Like on, if anybody watches my talk, oh no, you can't watch it because it's not online. But you know, a talk I did like 2 weeks ago about going to Denali. I don't think we really did much crevasse stuff before we went. But you know, Vanessa knows how to climb a rope and all that kind of stuff, and she would have worked it all out. But like a lot of things, when you fall in a crevasse, a lot of things aren't like ideal. Now, I once wrote an article on my blog. I think it's called "Doing a Bieber," because there's some really good footage of Justin Bieber where he was like dancing on the stage and he suddenly like stepped off the stage or fell down a hole in the stage. You know, and 1 minute is there, next minute he's like down this hole, and that is the problem with crevasses is they're not, you know, they're not how you They're not like in a film, you know, it's like, oh God, I'm going in, and like the thing starts crumbling and you start falling, you know, falling down into them. And it's not, it's never quite how you think it's going to be. Often it's about, you know, trying to avoid, I guess it's one of these things. Like when you work in a shop, you always think you can tell who the shoplifters are because they always look really, really dodgy. They're all kind of like heroin addicts, but that's because you can spot those ones. You know, it's the ones who look like a doctor. You never see those. So, you know, it's probably the crevasse you end up falling into could be, you know, it's probably going to be the one where you didn't think there was a crevasse there, and it just got you. So, but it's always really good to. It's always really good to establish, you know, good sort of good operating procedure on anywhere where there's crevasses, and take them seriously, because they're I know somebody in the they were right near the end of a crevasse, right at the end of a glacier, and they thought they were in a safe area, and I think they stopped for something, and then they were together, and the guy just started walking away, and he went straight down a crevasse, and he like had like a compound fracture. It was like blood everywhere, and it was like, you know, really it wasn't very nice. Until you can see like rocks, you know, proper rocks around, or you definitely know you're off the glacier, then always take it like super, super seriously. And the article I wrote, the doing the Bieber, was basically, if you're going to do any crevasse rescue, then you should always make it like as difficult as possible. Like try and do it wearing, you know, start hanging on a rope with a rucksack on and with your mitts on, and you know, trying to get your prussic loops off the back of your harness when you've got a big rucksack on and you've got all your layers on, you know, it can be really, really hard. So, you know, that's where you think, well, maybe I should just put my prussic loops on before, you know, or, you know, so you learn a lot of skills by, again, like that thing about, you know, the things you don't think about. So I often have this story that someone told me, he was in the SAS and Special Forces, and they were in this thing like the killing house, where they have this house all made out of rubber tires or something, and they, you know, they're practicing for entering rooms, and I think they probably invented the whole going into rooms and killing people kind of business. And they, you know, that kind of training, it's like layers and layers and layers of training, like it's like layered over, you know, maybe from the 1960s, and all the information that people learn, like in the Munich kind of Olympics, and was it Munich? Yeah, Munich, like, you know, all these kind of terrorist things. And so all this information, all this stuff you're being taught how to do, it's all layered over decades, you know, so you're just being told what to do, and you're following this standard operating procedure of like going into a room at this angle and all this kind of stuff. And he had this story where they were all like lined up about to, you know, like blow the hinges off this door or you know, hit with a sledgehammer or something. Then suddenly there was like a little gust of wind, and the door just like blew open started opening by itself. And he said like there was nothing, they would never taught what to do if a door opened by itself with a bit of wind, and no one knew what to do. Like for a second, like everyone froze, because their brains were like trying to like flick through the instruction manual for this situation, but they didn't. So I think in the end they just like all charged to the door and shut everything. So so what's that got to do with crevasses? I don't really know, but it's an interesting story. So so make life difficult. That's the thing. And expect the unexpected, and take it seriously. So another question, I've got a few questions here. Why did climbers in the 1800s up until the 1970s, I saw quite a few in the 80s too, insist on wearing knee-length trousers with long socks pulled up to their knees? I have been racking my brains for a functional explanation. I don't think it's for providing knee mobility, because the trousers came down to just below the knee. Why not wear trousers all the way down, or woolly tights all the way up? Never saw Joe Brown dressed like that, though. Joe Brown, a lot of those guys used to wear sort of paratrooper trousers, or, you know, like these sort of Denizen trousers, like from the Second World War, which were very baggy, baggy kind of canvasy trousers. They're probably ahead of the time, really. They're probably if you wore something like that now, you'd probably be quite cool. So your bag, you know, it's very heavy duty, sort of trousers. So I did have some breeches. Breeches, they were called, weren't they? Breeches. And Johnny Dawes still wears them. Johnny Dawes, he has these like corduroy ones that he wears. And I do actually remember, the thing about clothing, what we don't remember is a lot of clothing in the past wasn't elasticated. So you'd have people who had like woolen swimming trunks. So as soon as they went in the water, the trunks would just end up being super heavy and like 10 times bigger than they were before, and they would just fall down. So that's why like people would wear like a bathing suit. So they had like, you know, made out of wool. So they were, you know, they were actually like a, you know, like a leotard, like men and women. I think things like, you know, like elasticated sort of waistbands and things are probably quite a late invention, and I think lycra in clothing probably, I guess that was probably only coming in like probably at the end of the 70s maybe. So I know like people like Rowan like Super Striders and these kind of shola kind of fabrics, which were like stretch woven fabrics, were like really high tech at one time. And it's amazing, they're still, you know, like Patagonia guy trousers and that kind of stuff, they're still, you know, they feel kind of state of the art now, even though they're actually from like the 1970s really. So I would maybe I don't know, maybe it's like, you could say it's more functional. Like I had a pair of like Gore-Tex trousers once, and they were actually breeches, so they only went down to your knees. So if you're wearing like full-length gaiters, you know, you don't really need all that. You don't need all that extra, like two layers of Gore-Tex or two layers of gaiter. It's just kind of pointless. So as long as you're wearing gaiters and you have your over trousers on the outside of the gaiters, so the water doesn't flow down in through your gaiters, it's actually a kind of a better system in a way. And they did actually feel, you know, if it was hot, you could just pull down, you could just take your socks off or roll your socks down, you know, if it was hot weather in your breeches. And so that was kind of good. They just didn't have those, the, you know, lightweight, like polycotton, you know, polyester trousers, like I remember when Rowan in like polyester, are they polycotton? Anyway, trousers kind of appeared and they were pretty wacky. And so were Ronil Traxters, the idea of these kind of lycra, were they polyester or nylon sort of tracksuit bottoms? But those things are still like way better than almost a lot of the stuff, you know. They're probably way better than Patagonia trousers, you know, like crappy looking, you know, Ron Hill Tracksters, you know, the lightweight ones were bloody good, and they still are really good. You know, it's just, but we just get bored of stuff and we want something else, we want something newer. But they were really, really, really practical and super tough, last you forever. So yeah, so I would say, you know, like I think there's a question later on here about making your own gear. Like I would look into getting a pattern or trying some out, because, you know, shorts are really good, but having something that's a bit longer than a pair of shorts that protect your knees, not that you shouldn't use your knees when you're climbing, is pretty good. Like in New Zealand, you know, the classic thing about New Zealanders was they only ever wore shorts. You know, it had to be really, really bad to wear trousers. So I think maybe that kind of thing is a good idea, like the technical, you know, for technical kind of stuff. Thumbs up for breeches. Now there's I had a few questions here which are all in the same vein. So climbing wet rock, in Joe Brown's book, it seems that he went climbing every weekend regardless of whether the rock had snow or rain or whatever, even climbing through waterfalls. He describes rock climbing on Idwell slabs in the snow. The Mind Boggles, similar episodes on the Troll Wall book I just finished reading. I think climbing in wet weather, climbing on out of condition kind of rock is really, really good training. And I think that's how a lot of those climbers in the past, you know, your Doug Scotts and those kind of people, you know, they went out no matter how bad the weather was, and they'd either go like hill walking, you know, hill walking with some scrambling, or just going out rock climbing. And it's really good training, because especially if you're doing it in big boots and things, because you get a very good understanding of like your foot placements, which are really important when you come to dry tooling and mixed climbing, like knowing, because like a rock boot, you can sort of put a rock boot on a hold, and you can sort of smear it around and move your foot around. But when you're climbing in leather boots or plastic boots or whatever, you have to kind of you have to like hold your foot in a certain angle, and you can't really move it around. You know, you can't lift your heel up or whatever, otherwise it'll like pop off. So that's you know, and also you can often you can almost stand on things which are small. Not really, but you know you can stand on some really, really small holes in a pair of like, you know, solid boots that maybe you couldn't stand on in the rain in your rock boots. I don't know, that maybe that's why. The classic thing was people used to put socks on their, you know, socks on over their rock boots to make them more grippy. But at that time, people's rock boots were just plimsolls, really. They weren't like proper sticky rubber boots. But like probably the most dangerous thing you can do when you're climbing, I always think, is when you top out on a crag and it's a bit damp and you've got your rock boots on and it's very grassy, you know, you can like easily slip off. It's like ice. So maybe having your socks on might be quite good. And the socks are very thick, so. I would really recommend climbing in, you know, getting out there doing like what, you know, like Idwell slabs, or, you know, do some like really big, easy, long route in the rain, or if it's snowy or whatever. And like often if you're going to do sort of alpine climbing and that kind of stuff, you will often get in situations which are totally beyond the bounds of anything you've ever done before. You've not, like, you know, you might be good at mixed climbing and you might be good at rock climbing, but if you get in a situation where you have to rock climb in mixed climbing conditions, as in you don't have any ice axes or crampons, then having that experience of knowing how to do that is really, really important. You know, like verglassed rock, or you can, you know, you know, I've had situations where you're climbing and you've been using like your nut tool, and you've been like scraping the ice off holes with your nut tool, and, you know, climbing up. And sometimes you're just bringing together all these different skills, but very few people train in that kind of, I guess maybe it's like you call it a shoulder season climbing, where it's not winter and it's not summer, but it's somewhere in between. Like just knowing how to, I think in my book there's a bit where I talk about going to climb the, trying to climb Tangerine Trip in a day, and it took like 3 days, and we ended up in this big storm towards the end, and it was, you know, it was absolutely kind of hellish kind of conditions with like, I didn't have any socks on for some reason, and then when you gloves, and you're in this basically like mixed climbing with snow over slabs on the last two or three pitches, and you were literally like free climbing through waterfalls and through deep snow, but without any gloves on and with no socks on. And I had shorts on, but I didn't have like Gore-Tex trousers on. And there was some bits where I really don't think I would have ever got up the climbing without that kind of experience. And I was with Matt Dickinson, who was like a really super, super good climber, super good winter climber, alpine climber. And there was like one bit where he couldn't climb up it, and maybe because he was like so cold. So he came down and I did it, and I ended up like, you know, but I just end up having to use a cross between like throwing your rope up into the air and hoping it caught on something, and then pulling yourself up on it and just using some classic, you know, climbing like gritstone with snow on it kind of techniques where you, you know, you're just kind of using your whole body and getting into position and trying to relaxing that position, then moving really carefully to another position. And so, yes, yeah, so I'd highly recommend a bit of it. And it's good fun. You know, you just go out, do a few hours and then go to a cafe and have a nice cup of tea. So it's good. So here, so guidebook suggests to add a grade or two to the climb if it's wet. Yeah, I would agree with that. I'd probably start on something like really, really, really easy. So it's hard if you're just starting climbing. But a lot of the classic routes, like Great Gully on Craigerisfa in North Wales, is like one of the premium epic North Face the Eiger style wet horrible climbs you can do. I'd highly recommend it. I remember once when I went outside, there was people who were climbing like E9 who couldn't get up it, who were coming back from Wales saying, we tried to climb Great Gully and we couldn't do it, it's too hard. So I would highly recommend you go and do something like that. And there's like Clacay Gully up in Scotland, and there's loads of shit routes to do wherever you are. And then last question was, any top tips how to keep going upwards when the weather turns to shit? Kind of important self-rescue skill too. So I guess, yeah, just I'd say the same thing is just learn to, learn by climbing in conditions which aren't optimal, whether it's, you know, whether it's cold. Like I don't think I've ever had hot aches. So I've got very good circulation. So that makes a big difference. If it's so cold that your hands, you can't feel anything, that's not good. But sometimes you haven't got a choice. You have to just climb up to the top, you know, like classic routes, like, you know, like the Walker Spare or these kind of alpine routes where, you know, it could be like rock climbing at the bottom, and higher up it gets, you know, much, much sort of nastier really. So, new question. Enjoyed my podcast. I did this Denali podcast, talk, but I took it down because it wasn't that good. It was all right, but it wasn't good enough, and I need to, if we ever get to go out again, I'm supposed to go on tour, and that's part of the tour, so it's been taken out. Anyway, this guy was saying, thanks for that. I was looking back through your articles on the website and was thinking about trying to start making some of my own gear, even though I'm still working. I have some free time available due to lockdown. I have a couple of questions, though, as it's not something I've ever done before. What kind of sewing machine would I be looking for? What are essential, desirable features? Are there any basic and robust second-hand models for reasonable price that could be suitable for someone who has no previous experience? What would be a good first project that even for me would be difficult to fuck up completely? I have a copy of the 1979 Duke of Edinburgh design and make expedition equipment, if that helps. That sounds good. Apologies if you already answered that somewhere before and I haven't. That's from Mike, who works in a hospital in Glasgow, I think. So the sewing machine, like sewing machines sewing machines are like Breville sandwich makers, or like those George Foreman grills. Like a lot of people, there's a lot of them around. For a lot of projects, sewing projects, you can really use any sewing machine. It's only when you start getting into some sort of heavy duty stuff, like Cordura and webbing and that kind of stuff, and it kind of wrecks a sewing machine, you know. So you could go down to Argos or go down to Walmart and buy the cheapest sewing machine, and you could probably make, you know, you could make a bivy bag, you could make like a bothy bag, you could make stuff like that, and it would be fine. But it's when you want to, well, like when we went to Denali, we made our own bags for our pulks. So we made all sorts of stuff. And in the past, I've made quite a lot of like sleeping bags, like synthetic sleeping bags, which are like really, really simple things to make. What else have I made? I've made like loads and loads of stuff. And I think before, the sewing machine I had, It was a Pfaff. Is it Pfaff? It's like a German. It's like a heavy duty German sewing machine. And let's have a look on. I'll Google it. It's Pfaff. Yeah, and I just got it from. I just got it off eBay, and it's PFAFF, and it was like, you know, it had like a wooden base, and it was, you know, kind of heavy duty, and I can't remember. It didn't cost me like a huge amount of money, because there's a lot of people replace old sewing machines, you know, like even a Singer sewing machine, like a manual sewing machine, will actually sew some pretty heavy duty, you know, cause that's what people used to make everything out of, everything with a Singer sewing machine. You can often find those like almost like dirt cheap, you know, places. But if you want like a good all round one, then an old secondhand one is good. But maybe I'd buy it from a sewing machine. Find a sewing machine shop where they mend sewing machines and get one from someone like that, because it's very easy for someone to sell you a sewing machine that's broken and you don't know till you get it. And there's a lot of you know, the biggest thing for me was always like tension. There's a lot of tension stuff involved with sewing machines. The current sewing machine I have is a Singer heavy duty sewing machine, which is the only sewing machine I ever bought like brand new. And I don't know how heavy duty. Let's have a look. Heavy duty Singer. I'm Googling it live. Singer heavy duty kettlebells. No, Singer heavy duty sewing machine. And I got it from Argos, and they cost from Amazon. Oh, they're not available. You can't buy anything off Amazon these days. They've just sold out of everything. In America, oh god, not available. Everything's not available. I don't like it. Oh my god, no. So you can buy all these like fancy sewing machines that do all sorts of stuff that you don't really need. You know, they can do like for like real like hobby type person, but most people but if you're doing like outdoor stuff, you only really need to do like a standard stitch kind of machine, you can do like sort of bar tacking and stuff with that kind of thing. I'm still trying to find the price of the bloody thing. Singer. Yeah, that now we don't buy anything from getting from China anymore. No one's got anything to sell. So Singer one's probably a little bit expensive. It's like a hundred and something. You can basically buy various Singer sewing machines, but you can buy a secondhand Pfaff sewing machine off eBay. I think maybe mine costs like £60 or something. And it's like an old one. It's an old sewing machine. But a good place to... Oh, yes. So it's a 260. Mine was model 260. A really good place to start is go to Ray Jardine's website. Ray Jardine of the Cam, the man who invented the Cam, the friend. If you go to his website, which is like rayway.com, I think, and look at some of his patterns. Like he sells patterns for sleeping bags and tarps and all kind of stuff, but there's a lot of really good information on there about sewing machines, about threads, just like basic stuff. I know he sells a pattern and all the fabrics to build your own quilt, and it's really good. Like I built one. I used it on the Eiger, used it on the Winter Ascent of the Nose, like a two-person quilt. And it works really, really well. He's used his climb Mount Vinson, ski to the South Pole with it, and done all sorts of stuff with it. So really, really, really good introduction to sewing stuff. And the big thing for sewing, I think, is having enough space. You need a lot of space when you're sewing something big, like a big table or something. And a lot of it's like in the preparation. You need some good scissors. A really good thing I find are those metal sort of clips, those black clips, what they're called, not crocodile clips, but they're, you know, they're black and you hold paper together with them. Paper clips? No. Anyway, they're those clip things. I find those really handy for like holding together like heavy duty fabrics and things. And like the more you sew, you just have to work through it. It is kind of frustrating to begin with, but you can make you know, things like stuff sacks are super easy to make. You know, the more you do it, the more you kind of get comfortable with it, and you know, you just kind of get your head around it. And you're lucky because you've got so much information on the internet. You know, you just teach yourself to sew anything. You know, it's just all out there. You know, a friend of mine, Travis, who lives out in Talkeetna in Alaska, like he basically built his own house just from watching YouTube. He had no formal training of how to do anything. You know, build a house, but he built a house out of watching YouTube. So, so projects. Like a sleeping bag might seem like a big project, but it's not that difficult. It's not like making a shirt or a pair of trousers or whatever. It's actually quite easy to make a sleeping bag. Like bivy bags are good things to make. Tarp is a good thing to make. There's just like the more you start making stuff, the more you start like modifying stuff and adding stuff, and you realize it's not actually that difficult to make your own things. I've been really interested in, I had like a waistcoat that I got from Russia, which is for like big wall climbing, it was like a, you know, for attaching gear, but it was actually more like a waistcoat. It wasn't like a bandolier type thing for, you know, like cold kind of weather and stuff. And I've used it a few times and quite liked it. So it made me like go and look at about in the Second World War, they had these like jackets that they had for D-Day landings, which was a way of carrying a lot of gear, you know, rather than having webbing and all that kind of stuff. And so I was looking about that, and you just end up going into all these different interesting areas about clothing and, you know, stuff you could, you know, try and make. And it's, you know, the idea of like making your own jeans, you know, once you make one pair that fit you, you know, you just keep making everything. When they wear out, just make another pair, just buy a load of fabric and just keep making them. It's kind of cool, you know, make a pattern out of a piece of wood, you know, so the wood's just, you never, you know, it doesn't like get thrown away. So you got your patterns, and you know, it's quite a good thing. You know, if you see something, something and it looks, you know, it's like really specialized, but you realize it's actually quite easy, you know, easy to make. I'm going to start making my own carabiner soon. You know, I've got a forge and everything. So yeah, I don't know if that answered the question, but yeah, definitely check out Ray Jardine. There's a lot of good website. I've got a lot of good information about heavy duty sewing machines on sailing websites, because a lot of sailors have sewing machines for making sails, I guess. And they often use the same kind of sewing machines, like these Faf sewing machines. Make sure it's German. Another question. Hi Andy, I've read quite a few different articles from you. I really appreciate your work. You're welcome. I'll get straight to the point. Thank you. I've been climbing for quite a while. I've been rope solo climbing for some time. I adequately understand the dynamics of anchors, ropes, all the devices I own, including the potential failures of each of the pieces of the system. I've used a Wild Country Revo quite a bit for my solo climbing. I typically use a backup knots. I also own a Grigri. Would you recommend using a Grigri over a Revo? I have used a Grigri once or twice, but I shy away from it simply because of the drag trying to pull the rope through the device. If so, why? I have only climbed well below my limit, so as to prevent any need for really test my system. Because of that, I haven't taken any falls on either device. I know Joe Healy swears by his Maxim glider rope with an Edward Eddy. I am familiar with the Eddy, and I would frankly prefer to avoid another large purchase. What would you recommend as an ideal setup, given that I don't have a bottomless bucket of money or a silent partner? Thanks again, appreciate your work, blah blah blah. That's from Tanner. So I haven't had that question already, but I get like a lot of questions about rope soloing, mainly because I wrote a book about rope soloing. And unfortunately, when I wrote the book about rope soloing, all the rope soloing devices in it were stopped manufacturing them literally the day the book came out. So the soloist, the silent partner, the solo aid, all of them, you can't buy them anymore. So that's a pain. So it means that people who want to do like rope soloing, as in you start at the ground and you're climbing up, like lead rope soloing, of being left in the lurch, really, because the only thing that worked really well was a silent partner. And the silent partner's what, like Pete Whittaker used a silent partner when he soloed, sort of free soloed El Cap. You know, he used a silent partner. So it's a really good device. Like, it'd be interesting if you could get, you know, if you get like 2,000 people together wanting to buy one, and he went to Rock Exotica and were like, look, we've got 2,000 people want to buy this thing. Can you make 2,000 more if they would do it? Because I don't think it's about certification. But, you know, I don't know if it's because it's obviously a device where people are really worried about being sued about it. Like I get worried about writing a book about it, because it's, you know, it's like I wasn't a member of the rope soloing Facebook group, but it just terrified me so much, some of the stuff that people were talking about, that I had to leave, because I thought it's like, you know, you got some moral responsibility to tell people they're going to kill themselves, but after a while you haven't got the time. So people are now being left with using like some other kind of I call them ABBD, so it's a automatic assisted braking belay device, so a gree-gree basically. Now, a big problem with drag with a lot of these devices is, so you've got the, like, and this is going to be boring for people who aren't interested in this kind of stuff, but basically you've got on one side, you've got like the live rope, which is going down to the belay. You know, you have a belay at the bottom, you climb up, so the rope's attached to the belay and it goes into your device, and as you climb, you're clipping the rope in, you're clipping your gear, you're clipping that live rope coming out of your gree-gree or whatever into the gear. Then if you fall, the gree-gree should lock you. So instead of having someone holding the gree-gree at the bottom of the rope attached to you, instead of having someone at the bottom of the rope with a gree-gree and the rope's attached to you, the rope's attached to the bottom of the belay and the gree-gree's at your end, if that makes any sense, or the belay device is at your end. So, you know, if you were good, you could just belay with a normal belay device, you know, with an ATC, and when you fell off, you just grabbed the rope. But you'd have to be quite quick, otherwise you'd die. So by having like an assisted belay device, like a gree-gree, then it means that that should, exclamation marks, is exclamation marks, those marks, anyway, speech marks, what do they call them? exclamation marks, should stop you, but it's not guaranteed, because that's not what it's designed for. There's like a lot of things that go wrong. Like, you can cross-load the gree-gree, cross-load the carabiner. The gree-gree can get fouled up on something, like a fifi hook can get caught inside the fifi, inside the thing, and stop it from, you know, locking. There's like loads and loads of things that go wrong. So that's why, if you're ever going to do it, I advise you to do it where you don't think you're going to fall off, and B, always have a backup knot, so you're clipped in with a backup knot. So the big problem is to do with the weight. So if you imagine like the device is like what do you call it? The middle of like a pulley. Is it like a pulley? It's in the middle, and you've got ropes on either side of it. You've got your live rope and your dead rope. Now, if one rope gets too heavy, it'll start locking up the device. Or worse still, the rope will start feeding through the device by itself and it won't lock up. So if, say, you're like 40 meters above the ground and you've got 40 meters of rope below you, and you've got like 20 meters of rope on your side, then suddenly you can get this thing where the rope starts like creeping through. You know, if you weren't careful, the whole rope could like feed all the way through the device if you didn't have a backup knot. So you won't want that to happen. So generally, what you're trying to do is avoid too much rope on either side. So when you're tying a backup knot, you're creating this loop of rope. So you never want the loop of rope, the backup, which is going from your device, a loop, and then to the backup knot. And then the end of the knot goes down to the rest of the rope, which is either in a rope bag or whatever. You never want that loop to be either too big or too small. If it's too small, the weight, there's not enough weight to make it work properly. It's really hard to explain. You have to get the book. There's a photograph in it. So you're trying to balance these two things. And another thing is like the diameter of the rope. You know, you're better with like a thinner rope is going to move more easily. And if you have the belay, if you have the gri-gri sort of attached in a certain way, like have it on like a sling, so it's like held more upright, then the rope will feed through a lot easier without jamming. But then if you fall upside down, you've got more risk of the of it not locking up at all. So it's really difficult. It's like when I was talking about moving together on a snowy mountain, like there isn't really a safe option. Like a silent partner was good because it would work in any direction. If you fell off, it would work upside down, sideways, whatever. Where a gri-gri style device doesn't work so well. Now the Wild Country Revo works differently to all the other ones, in that it's got more of it. It actually works more like a silent partner. And I expect, like, Pete bought a silent partner. So Pete Whittaker I give Peter Whittaker a copy of my soloing book, and then that inspired Pete to get into rope soloing. And he bought like a silent partner where you can still buy them. Now Pete's sponsored by Wild Country, and I kind of suspect that Wild Country looked at the silent partner and thought, oh, you could make like a belay device out of this. So if it works like a silent partner, then it could be quite good. Now the only reason I've never really said to use it is I am a little bit dubious about Wild Country the last few years. I kind of wanted to see what happened to the Revo, like if it you know stood the test of time, you know, if nothing bad came out of it, like, you know, like something, they all got recalled because they weren't working. You know, I didn't want to ever say like try it. Well, I can't say try it because it's not designed for that. So if you're going to try using a Revo, you have to do it on your own, you know, on your own back, really, because it's you could kill yourself. And with all this stuff, the Grieger is the same. It's not designed for that. You can use it, and lots of people do use it, but it's not what Petzl recommend you use. So it's kind of one of those it's one of those questions where if you have to ask the question, then the answer is no. And if you don't think no is the right answer, then I'd just do what you think. Does that make sense? Do what you think. Because none of it is like super, super safe. You've always, like, when you're like big wall climbing, it's not so bad. You know, you can get away with like a gri-gri or whatever, because you're going quite slowly. You can kind of feed the rope out yourself if need be. You know, but like free climbing is a lot more difficult. It takes a lot more effort, but it is possible. Like I saw your man who, you know, who free rope soloed the nose. I can't remember his name, a Japanese man. You know, I kind of saw him there. We were having a conversation about rope soloing as he was like rope soloing up the nose. And he, you know, he used the gri-gri and he obviously got it to work like amazingly well. So, you know, there's loads of advantages. Like Jean-Christophe Lafay used a gri-gri. Really, you know, very effectively on a lot of like really hard solos, and he used to use it with a very, you know, a very thin rope, like seven and a half mil rope or something, you know, which it's not designed for that kind of rope, but he, you know, managed to get it to work. So it's one of those things. It's like, you know, it's like making your own, you know, jet shoes or something. You know, you really need to know what the hell you're doing. And if you're not sure what you're doing, then just try and do it. But just be really, really careful and just slowly find your way through it. Like I've taken like two falls, like when I was rope soloing on a gri-gri, and one time the gri-gri didn't lock for some reason. But the aider clipped into a piece of gear, and that's what stopped me. And then another time I fell off. And I didn't think I didn't think I was gonna fall off, and it was a bit wet. And then, well, you know, next minute you're like, I think I had a really long rope. I think when I was going to try to solo the Harlan on the Eiger, I was like practicing climbing on like a 100 meter rope. So I could like string like three pitches together with one rope. And I fell off on with this like long rope, and I had so much stretch, you know, went like for miles for it. But the gree-gree did actually work. So the idea that you're not going to fall off is, it has to be like super easy, and there's always that chance you can fall off. I guess it's all about averages and stuff. So final question, then you can all go home. You can put your chairs up and go home. I might have had this one already. So have a look. Hi Andy, good to see the podcast developing. He's probably not listened to it very long. I was just wondering what your thoughts are on good climbing destinations to meet partners. I don't know if that's like sexual partners. Good conditions at this time of year. Not sure when this was. I work in events which are suspended for the foreseeable, so a month-long break is on the cards. Blah blah blah. Anyway, so this was actually just at the beginning of the lockdown. This is actually an old email. About places to go in the world, like rock climbing, where you've got good weather, you can meet people to go climbing. I don't know if we're ever gonna be allowed to go or travel anymore. Only rich people will be able to travel, as I expect. I did see, like, I think all the rich people just wrote a letter saying, you know, we need to stop all the poor people from from, you know, doing anything from now on because it's spoiling the world. I think it's those fucking assholes who spoiled it, not us. So, I think my answer for this was, you know, great places to go where you can guarantee you can go climbing. I hope I haven't answered this question before, but I think I said like Arapiles is a really good place in Australia, and Yosemite. There's probably other places you could go, but they were like the two I kind of think there's places probably in like Mexico and other places. But other places you go, like Red Rocks in Las Vegas, is like absolutely a phenomenally amazing place to go rock climbing. Like absolutely amazing. Like if you're a British climber and you're used to climbing in, you know, like adventurous places, like it's really amazing, absolutely amazing place to go climbing. But it's not so easy to just. There's not so many people like hanging around where there is in places like Arapiles. And the problem with like the Alps and places, the same thing, like the weather never seems to be so good, and people all, you know, are very transitory, like everyone just leaves and goes somewhere else. And I thought like Arapiles was like a really solid place to just like lots and lots of climbers all sitting around, like, you know, very casual climbing with each other. And the same with Yosemite, like less so in Tuolumne. It's just not the same in Tuolumne, but very good place to go. Like if anyone's like, you know, gets made redundant and they just want to, if you've got enough money to just try and get somewhere until things get better, like Yosemite's probably a good place. But if you're not that you're allowed to leave. Like in the UK, it's like there isn't anywhere like that. I think it's kind of changing. Climbing has changed a lot, in that there's probably more places where people, you'd go and there'd be like a lot of climbers who were just sort of hanging around for like months on end. But I don't think those days seem to exist anymore. I think people seem to have jobs and careers and like real lives and things to get on with. So I can't really think of any, you know. So maybe it's more fun if you got like a limited time. I went to this amazing place in Australia, Munari, which is like, you know, really 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 beautiful, like wild place, but you know, it's like in the outback. But you know, we were there for like maybe like a month or 3 weeks or something, and I think we only ever saw like five people or something. So in Arapiles is just like tons and tons of people to go climbing with. So yeah, so I think I'm sure he's probably stuck like me. He's probably in his house just thinking he'd like just to go to like Scarborough or somewhere, or just go to the end of the go to the 3 kilometers from his house. But you know, I think I'm going to get into sea kayaking, I think. I think I'm going to explore the coast of Ireland. I think I'm going to lower my sights a little bit and just lower my expectations. That's always a good thing to do in life, is like, you know, reduce your expectations of everything, and then you'll always be happy. So that's the, you know. So on that cheery note, I shall be doing. I wasn't going to do a talk this week on Wednesday night. Wednesday night, 8 o'clock Dublin time, which is probably the same as English time. But for some reason, all the English people turned up an hour late last time or the time before. So I wasn't going to do it, but then a few people were like, "Oh, it's like highlight of my week." So now I feel like I have to do it for those people. So I'm probably going to do about skiing across Greenland, and I'm going to do. It's kind of funny. Funny story, go across Greenland with someone in a wheelchair who can't walk. Lots of interesting, funny stories there. People think it's really impressive if you go across Greenland, you know, if you're paralyzed, paraplegic, but, you know, you're sitting down the whole way. What is it, you know, how hard can it be? So, maybe the week after that, I might do, I've got a talk I'd do about soloing, which talks about soloing, like See Your Dreams and all those kind of all that kind of good stuff. So and I'll try and do another. I'm going to do another podcast where I'm interviewing someone. I hope people. I don't know if that one with Pete was good or not, because I don't like listening to these things after they're done. But I've had some nice people said some nice things about it. So, but I'm just waiting to get some more wires for my computer so I can try and make it sound less crap. So yeah. So anyway. If you like this podcast, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff, and press like, ring the bell, all that kind of stuff, and I shall speak to you soon. Someday.
As a major research institution, Arizona State University offers the most online bachelor's degree programs, along with world-class faculty and dedicated support. Discover why ASU is ranked number one in innovation for 9 consecutive years. Tap to learn more.